Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of July. Yesterday in the Rose Garden, President Obama, speaking of health care reform, said there are going to be more debates and more disagreements before all is said and done, but health care reform must be done. Inaction is not an option for those naysayers and cynics who think this is not going to happen. Don't bet against us. We are going to make this thing happen. So what is this thing that might happen when it comes to reforming America's healthcare system? We continue our series this week. Last week, we learned about the Canadian system of healthcare, and next week, the French. Our guest this hour says the American healthcare system has shown signs of strain for years, while incremental changes have succeeded, broad reforms have failed to garner support. The Clinton plan collapsed under the weight of its complexity. Many other proposals also failed to achieve sufficient consensus to survive the legislative process. President Obama has identified health care reform as a clear priority, but the pathway to reform is less clear. Bill Ptasnik is with us this hour. He is president and CEO of Frederick Hospital and the Frederick Community Health System. This is a regional hospital system, which is really quite huge. It's made up of Frederick Community Memorial Hospital, Menominee Falls, St. Joseph's Hospital in West Bend, and the West Bend Clinic. He chairs the long-range policy committee for the American Hospital Association and has been part of negotiations with the White House in that role in terms of hospitals and healthcare reform. He was also deputy director and CEO of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. University of Iowa, a dear place in the hearts of both Rhonda and me. We both went to school there. And also CEO of UNC Hospital and senior associate director of the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics. Bill, thank you very much for being with us. Let's start with, there's some concern about whether or not we're going to see health care reform. The president's been criticized for dragging his feet on this, for not making a public plan a priority. Can you give me an assessment of where things are now in the middle of the summer? Will we see some kind of reform?
Yeah, I'm actually convinced, Kathleen, that we will. There are obviously a lot of moving parts that we're dealing with. But there have been a lot of lessons learned from 1993, and this administration clearly has studied what went wrong during that time period, and they don't want to see the same thing happen. So I'm actually convinced something will happen. Now, we're still in the midst of the sausage-making process, so it's a little bit early yet to make an absolute prediction.
Mm-hmm. The big thing is the public health plan, which would ensure many more people, and there's a lot of controversy. Would this become all government all the time? Obviously, you know the intricacies of this. Should there be as much controversy about this as there is, and what are your thoughts about a public health plan?
Well, I guess first and foremost, I'm not sure that there actually will be a public plan come out. I think there's a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering. There are a lot of different groups in Congress working through it. You have the House side, and there are three committees of jurisdiction. The House clearly is putting forth a public plan. It's less clear right now, though, whether the Senate Finance Committee, who many of us feel is the key group, will in fact produce a public plan. If you take a step back, the purpose of the public plan was really to try to create some pressure on the insurance industry to reform their underwriting practices, which many of us would agree needs to be overhauled. And the use of the public plan to kind of force perhaps a movement to community rating to really deal with the issues of a number of individuals are denied coverage because of pre-existing condition, the public plan would have forced that change. Whether or not in the end of the day we're going to see a public plan, I think many of us who have dealt with this would be very surprised if this actually emerges this year.
Why?
Well, I think, first of all, it is controversial. And it could compromise the end game, which is to expand coverage. The purpose and what we want to make sure happens is that at least 95, if not more, Americans are covered. And to the extent that the public plan becomes a divisive element in kind of sabotaging that effort, I think this administration is smart enough to know, when to pull back. And I think while the president has clearly articulated an interest in the public plan, He's also been very careful to make sure he's not put in a corner and to keep open the discussions on this broader reform agenda.
Mm-hmm. And so you've studied the issue. You've been involved in discussions about this for a long time. You have identified the common themes when it comes to reform: access to coverage, timely access to appropriate care, enhanced wellness and prevention efforts, quality and value. What reform do you think needs to take place, Bill, to ensure that we get all of that?
Well, I think what a number of us are focusing in on is we want broad systemic reform. We just don't want payment reform. And the concern that that is occurring right now, because this is a cost issue, how are we going to come up with $1 trillion to cover this?
That's a lot of money.
That the pressure to reduce expenditures kind of assumes the major priority in that systemic reform. Now, what do I mean by systemic reform? We basically in this country now have a chronic disease system encased in an acute care system of care. Any of us who are dealing with loved ones who have a chronic problem understand the issues of coordination of care, understand the complexity of managing. This does require kind of a change in orientation in terms of how healthcare is delivered, clearly how it's going to be financed as a part of this process. And so I think that's the issue that a lot of us want to make sure happens, is that this is a broad-based effort, that health reform has several moving parts to it. It has to have a focus on wellness. It has to require greater focus on quality and transparency. It's got to be affordable. And it has to have linked together by an information system that's interoperable. So when we think about health reform, and when the American Hospital Association thinks about health reform, we think about all of these different parts. And then number one, there has to be a situation where there is coverage for all, paid for by all. The fact that we have 50 million Americans, and that's equivalent to the population of 24 states. That's unacceptable, and that has to be center stage in this. But coverage alone won't deal with these other issues of wellness and the population, the care needs that are important.
I was reading an interesting statistic from the World Health Organization, which I'd like for you to respond to, calculating that at least, they say, 80% of all heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes, and up to 40% of cancer could be prevented if we had wellness programs, yet we spend less than 2% of our healthcare dollars on disease prevention.
No, I've read that similar report and have been a big advocate over the years that we have to have a wellness focus. The rates of diabetes is soaring. The obesity problems are soaring. The comorbidities that are linked to that are significant. I see it as I walk the halls of our institution. We've created our own problems, our own health problems, because of a lack of focus on wellness. And those costs associated with that are incredibly significant, and they're growing.
Mm-hmm. You, I know, have been involved, and I'm not exactly sure what the details are of this, but there was some kind of deal struck with hospitals that the hospitals agreed that they would lower their costs significantly. You would accept lower payments for Medicare. Can you tell me about those negotiations with the administration and what hospitals in the country have already agreed to?
Well, the American Hospital Association is the largest trade association. We represent some 4,500 hospitals in this country. We have been proactive. We have had a longstanding position with regard to fostering change and reform of our system. We firmly believe that what we're doing today is not sustainable. The price tag of this package, and again, the package is fluid. It's hard to kind of define yet what it is. But the president had asked that all these different stakeholders really step forward and be a part of this process, be part of the solution. And we've been in negotiations with the White House, with the Senate Finance Committee, and last week struck a deal would say, well, we're willing to do our part if there is truly a movement to coverage for all. And the president initially had asked for commitments of around $250 billion, which would have been draconian in terms of cuts to hospitals over a 10-year period. What we have committed to is to do our part to reduce Medicare expenditures by about $155 billion over a 10-year period. But it has to be linked to this broader focus on coverage and access. So this is intertwined. That $150 billion is linked to that we will set a goal in this country that 95% of the population is covered. And hospitals are prepared to do their part with regard to work that we're already doing. Significant efforts are underway in quality and quality improvement and transparency, process improvement. Some of the goals that we're already working on, but we're trying to intensify those efforts.
When we talked with somebody from the University of Toronto last week about the Canadian healthcare plan, he started the show talking about a philosophy of healthcare in that country and that it was a community responsibility to make sure that everybody had access to healthcare. That was striking to me because I don't think we have the same kind of philosophy in this country, and it's part of the problem of insuring, which I, no matter what your political persuasion, people think they ought to have healthcare. There's no reason for 50 million people. That's horrible in this country. So I want to talk more about this issue of access. How do you get to 95%? How do you get to 100%?
Right. Well, you know, for someone who's been in this field for now 40 years, it's been a long time. Like many of us in healthcare in the 60s, we embrace healthcare as sort of a passion linked to community service and trying to really focus on making this a better world and our communities better. I think it's painful that 40 years later, we're still debating whether healthcare is a right or a privilege. And I think a lot of the European countries who I've had a chance to study and meet with leaders in those countries, that decision was made. And we're still debating this. There's still issues with regard to is healthcare a right? And I think as a result, the way we've approached this has been very different. And, you know, clearly we have an excellent health system when you look at the use of technology. And as Americans, we're very impatient. We want choice, and we want to be seen now. And the Canadian systems, the others, choice is not a key issue. And it is a very different mindset that I'm not sure in this country we're prepared to deal with. And I think that's part of the trade-offs that we have to work through. There is a different orientation when you talk to European leaders with regard to how they approach health system, their health care. And that mindset is not one that is pervasive in this country.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about just having returned recently from Paris. We're doing France next week on our show. When you look at, and you're a student of healthcare systems in the world, do you look at France and say, oh, if we could only be like France, oh, if we could only be like England, are there models that you think we ought to learn from, Bill?
Yeah, actually, I think it's unfortunate that we're focused, that people quickly talk about government-run healthcare and they point to Canada and to England. That's really not the model that is the pervasive model in other countries. It is built around an insurance model. It is built around, if you look at the Swiss system, it's built around the point that everybody needs coverage and must have insurance. Those that can't afford it, the government does supplement. But there's more of an individual mandate, an individual requirement that is there as a part of it. There is choice. Not to the extent that there is choice here, but there is choice. The role of the insurance industry is very different. It's nonprofit. This country is the only one that has allowed this proliferation of a for-profit oriented insurance model that is a contributor, I believe, to why our administrative costs are so high. Mm-hmm. In the European countries, the administrative model is 5 to 8 to 10%. Here it's 20 to 25 to 30% as a part of it. But it is not government run. It's not a quote a government run health system because there's still much of individual organizations and providences that are involved in how healthcare is organized. But it does set separate different standards. And I think the other thing that impressed me as you talk to these leaders is they do understand that healthcare is about chronic disease, and there's much more care coordination than is occurring in this country.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for you. We have all our lines going, so we'll get to our callers momentarily. We're talking about what's on the table in terms of health care reform here in the United States, and our guest is Bill Ptasnik. He is CEO, president of Freidert Hospital, which is based here in Milwaukee, 2008 chair of the American Hospital Association, the nation's largest trade group for hospitals and healthcare systems. He's been at Freidert since 1993, and before that, he was with the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, and also has been with the University of North Carolina Hospitals, and CEO of UNC Hospital and University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinics. He's a student of healthcare reform. He has traveled all over the world and knows a lot about healthcare elsewhere, and also what is realistic in terms of reform in this country. So we'll go to your phone calls. We need to pause for just a moment. Here's the number. Our lines are filled, but you'll be able to get through eventually at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're going to go to phone calls now for Bill, and let's start with Judy. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. This mention of the Swiss model.
Judy, you got a phone? You got your radio on?
I'm sorry, it's quite a ways away. I didn't think it would bother you.
Oh well, it's.
It is.
Yeah, it
if
is,
you
Judy.
Take me one more caller away, I'll go turn it off.
Thank you, Judy.
Thanks.
All right, let's go to Paul next from Slinger. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Doctor. I have two questions. And the first question is this. The sickness and accident insurance industry has a situation where it's a mature industry, and so to grow, they have to steal from competitors. Now, if Congress passed a law that said that the insurance industry, if they're going to raise their rates, they have to raise it uniformly across their insured base so they can't cherry-pick, because that's what they do now. They unload the poor soul that either had a genetic defect or had an accident. So if you did that, wouldn't you make the about 1,600 major insurance delivery entities redundant? Maybe they'd merge because they have redundant overhead and staff. That's my question.
Okay.
Well, you know, I think this whole area of insurance obviously is complex because how it's set up, how it's organized, who has jurisdiction over it. What we've seen in this country is a real change from how insurance was established, how it was covered, the level of accountability. And I think many of us feel that, you know, we clearly do need to be thinking about insurance reform that really has a focus on coverage, as opposed to making it very difficult for people to gain access. And this movement away from community-based rating, which says we're all in this together and sharing the risk, is no longer the predominant model of insurance coverage. And I think that's part of what Congress is trying to wrestle with.
Thanks for the call. I need to remind everybody, you got to turn your radio down before you talk to us, too, or you get this echo and it drives everybody crazy. Tom is next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. One of the things I don't see being addressed with the Obama plan or what you're talking about is the administrative cost.
I would agree with that. I think, again, part of the administrative cost is linked to, again, the insurance model. Medicare is a relatively low cost from an administrative perspective in terms of producing the bill and getting payments and whatever. It's around a 6 to 7 to 8% overhead cost. That compares on the commercial side to 20 to 25%. Part of that is the return on investments. Part of that is just the cost of processing and the complexities of that everybody is dealing with because there's lack of standardization. So as an institution, we have a whole building full of billing individuals that are trying to understand the regulations, understand how to bill the insurance companies, and that's part of the administrative cost simplification that has to be built into any reform effort. I think that's a core requirement, And that is an area where we do stand out when you look at what other European countries are covering, are costing, or are paying for in terms of administrative costs versus what we are. I mean, we're 10, 15, 20% higher than what most of the European countries are as it relates to the administrative side of processing.
Thanks for the call. This is where things get kind of fuzzy for me because I don't understand how this would be done. I don't know what the motivation would be to do anything here if you didn't have a public plan. There's been some talk about the president would not worry so much about getting rid of his idea of a public plan if the marketplace could provide sufficient competition of its own. How does the marketplace do that? What's the incentive to do that? They're making a lot of money right now. Why would you go and do something different? What's the incentive?
Well, I think to the credit of the insurance industry, they are taking the position, which is very different than they did in 1993, that they are willing to change their business model if everyone is covered. And what they're dealing with right now is the issue that not everyone is covered, and therefore they don't want to get caught with regard to a product that mostly people with pre-existing conditions or adverse selections are dealing with. And again, that's part of why I think community rating is important as opposed to what we have here is experience rating, which takes a small company in a situation where if you have a cancer patient, suddenly your premium costs are dramatically different as opposed to spreading that over the entire community and on a larger base.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of what the insurance companies are really themselves trying to say is we can reform, that the market dynamics will, if everybody is covered, will allow us to do things differently, and you don't need a public plan to make those changes.
Mm-hmm. And do you have fears, some have said, that if you had a government plan, I don't know, maybe it would be so good, everybody would like it so much that you would completely change the healthcare system and all those private insurance companies would be by the wayside?
Well, again, that is the concern, is that over time you will move very quickly into a single-payer system. Now, obviously, there are a lot of people that say, well, that's fine, let's move in that direction. I'm not one who really believes that. I do believe in some level of competition, not necessarily what we have totally in healthcare, because I think competition has been a divisive level. But I think the issue is one of how do you meet and cover the financial requirements. The Lewin Group just did a study in saying that a public plan would undercapitalize the health system. And the health systems, I mean, we do require technology. I mean, I'm benefiting from it, you're benefiting from it, and it is costly. And the concern is the reimbursement rates that would be associated with a public plan would understate the requirements. And in fact, we would see a significant erosion in the quality of health care in this country. And to some of that, I believe that could be true.
Mm. Let's go back to phone calls. Judy is with us now. Hi, Judy.
Thank you so much. This conversation already is helping my thoughts. But I think if you are going to allow competition and profit, not the profit, but even allowing competition in, it's just not going to be efficient. And what I'd like is to hear what happened in other countries when, if they had insurance that was profiting and they switched to nonprofit in their countries, how did they do that? What happened in other countries with their insurance industry? Thanks.
Well, that's a great question because as I have observed and have read and have talked to leaders in some of these other countries, the insurance role is very different. It is built around a nonprofit basis. It's viewed as a mechanism for distributing risk, and their role is very different, and the attitude is very different, and they're more involved in care coordination strategies as a part of this process, and I think it has engendered a different orientation than what has occurred now, where there's a lot of tension points that exist between providers and insurers, and the rules of engagement are very different.
Let's talk a little bit more. Thank you, Judy, for, about costs here. We've spent some time talking about administrative costs. What about what you've described as intensity of services in this country? What does that mean?
Well, I think what we're seeing is it's utilization. It is perhaps doing more than what is necessary, or if you looked at clinical efficacy, you know, the RAND did a study, and there are various other studies that have said 25 to 30% of the care being rendered in this country is perhaps unnecessary. There's a real concern in Washington that the fee-for-service system, which is the pervasive model, really misaligns incentives because you get paid by doing more. And that fee-for-service system has contributed to increased utilization as a part of that, and it doesn't necessarily focus in on outcomes. So I think intensity of service is the use of technology. It's the number of tests and procedures that are being utilized. It's how we treat end-of-life care in this country, which is very costly, and again, very different than when you talk to your European colleagues in terms of what they do. It's all part of that in terms of contributing to this problem of increased utilization.
That end-of-life care is touchy, isn't it? Because
it
we
is.
All want to live forever. We don't really accept the fact that we're going to die.
You know, we don't really deal with that very well.
No.
In this country, in terms of our medical students struggle with that. We're a big training program, and you know, that's not something that's not our orientation. And yet, I think that it has to become as our population ages. That is going to be an important factor. You know, 80% of the cost of care in this country is the last 2 years or so.
80%.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, and I think, again, we can't say it's time to stop. And I think in the end, that is something that can't be mandated, but it is a factor in terms of why costs in this country are so high.
And what about other countries? Do they suspend certain kinds of unnecessary procedures because death is imminent?
Well, at this conference that I was at, a lot more discussion about hospitals without walls, about moving people quickly, but about identifying when enough is enough. And the focus needs to be on palliative care and more acceptance of that in terms of the social service agencies are more in tune to that. You know, the cost is covered as a part of the health plans and the insurance models. Most families here are faced with a significant problem if you now have a loved one that doesn't need hospitalization and needs care of a caregiver. Most people don't have the insurance for that, and the family has to provide that, and that's becoming increasingly difficult. In many of the European countries, that's a benefit. That's a part of the benefit package because in the end they feel that it'll save cost. And unfortunately, in the discussions right now in Washington, there aren't these kinds of discussions. So when I said earlier about systemic change, there's not enough attention being given to this issue because it is an emotional one. It's difficult. It's a personal one. It's one that you frankly don't want government intervention, but you want government to play a role in terms of how some of this is financed, to allow families to make decisions a little bit differently.
Well, it's going to have to be addressed as people live longer, Bill, don't you think? We have to come to terms with it.
Well, I think, again, it's one of the contributors of why people are saying the current system is not sustainable as a part of that.
Let's go to Lucy next. Lucy is from Melbourne? You're calling us from Australia, Lucy?
Yes, but I'm in Wisconsin at the moment.
Okay.
I'm on Highway 94, actually, but I'm not driving. I'm stopped.
Thanks,
That's
Lucy.
Good.
Before I ask my question, may I just make a comment? Because I have followed this debate for quite some months, both since I've been in the country visiting, but also beforehand when I listened to American radio stations on the internet. And I've often heard people make comments about we don't want it run by the government. We don't want the government to do this and we don't want the government to do that. I've never heard anybody say we don't want our health system run by insurance companies, because the American health system is not run by the doctors. Now, the other thing that that really comes to mind as an outsider looking in this country, when it comes to healthcare and many other things, I hear a lot of comments about this is my right and that is my right. But I rarely hear a comment about this is my responsibility and that is my responsibility. And they are just things that I like to throw into the pan for consideration. My question is, the doctor you have there, has he studied the Australian system?
Actually, the meeting I was at was an international meeting, and there was someone from Australia that was there. And this question of individual responsibility came up as a part of it, and it's an interesting dialogue. This question of government run is also one that I find somewhat fascinating. I was in Texas maybe about a year ago at a hearing, and someone got up and said, well, whatever you do, don't let the feds take over Medicare. Well, Medicare is a federally run program in this country. I think it's one of those terms that it's hard to understand. The government is involved in our healthcare system at a very significant level. 60% of our revenues, if you look at Medicare, Medicaid, and other sources. So the government is involved. I think what people are saying, though, is they don't want the government to make decisions that necessarily affect decisions that they should be making or their families should be making. And I think that's the issue we have to kind of work through. This is not about government-run healthcare. This is about the financing of healthcare. But the decision points need to be left with the individual family member, their physicians, and the institutions that interface that. And I think that's where people struggle with.
Do you like your? Do you have any problems with your system, Lucy, in Australia?
Oh, of course there are problems with all systems, and over the last 30 or 40 years it has been fine-tuned. But the point is that the rates are set by doctors. Mm-hmm. The doctors are not dictated to by the government that they must charge this or that. Mm-hmm. The thing is that the government subsidizes and finances the doctor's visits up to a certain point. But the insurance companies, although they are for-profit insurance companies, are highly regulated insofar as that you cannot, if a doctor chooses to charge $400 and the government decides that particular service only gets $100 rebate because most doctors are charging $120 or whatever, then you cannot insure to cover the other $300. It's impossible. There is no insurance permitted. So that, in a sense, stops doctors from being way over the top. But like every system, always there will be problems, and all systems need fine-tuning all the time as they go through. But I really think we've got the best of both worlds down under.
Okay. Thank you. You may have, as a result of this call, added Australia to the list of countries that we're looking at. Thank you, Lucy, so much for your call. We go next to Matt from Grafton. Hi, Matt.
Hello?
Hi, Matt. Go right ahead, Matt.
Hello. Yeah, I needed, I guess, a little bit of an education, because the only hang-up I still have left with healthcare reform...
Just keep talking, Matt.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
It's all right.
It occurred when my brother joined the military, and what I see is his health insurance being such a huge part of his paycheck, which for what he's doing isn't enough as it is. And then I see someone like myself who chooses to go to law school and might simply be given free health care. And I have a fairness issue there, and I don't know if I just don't understand how this is going to play out, but I wanted thoughts on that.
He's in the military and he's paying a lot for health insurance?
No. What I'm saying is, in the military, and the insurance he's given is part of his paycheck. He's
earning that
health insurance, whereas I would not be if it was simply given to me.
Okay, I misunderstood. Bill?
Well, I think, again, this is not an easy question to respond to. I think the idea is that if everyone is covered, the cost of insurance actually will go down because through underwriting and others right now, directly or indirectly, you're paying for the fact that a number of 50 million Americans aren't covered. You know, we see a tremendous number of uninsured that come through our emergency room. We provide care. We're obligated to provide care, and the cost of providing that has to be paid by someone, so it's distributed differently. The theory here is that if everyone is covered in this country, the actual cost of that coverage per individual would go down. And if there are the right incentives in place, that the cost of care through systemic changes actually would go down. And at that point, the cost of what we're paying in this country for health care would be reduced. So there's a lot, and that's why I talk about a lot of moving parts here. You can't just kind of look at one element of this. This is kind of like a moving target. And I think that's the piece that policymakers and others struggle with, because some of this is kind of a whim and a prayer that this will, in fact, work out. And that's why when you talk about now in Washington a 10-year timeline, that's significant, and a lot can occur over that 10-year period. The assumption here is that if everybody is covered, the cost of care will go down because of the hidden taxes that are occurring in terms of those that are currently uncovered, and hospitals will continue to become more efficient, and the health system will become more efficient through electronic medical record systems and interoperability.
Thanks for your call. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the proposals for reform that are before America as we continue our healthcare series. Bill Ptasnik is our guest. Bill is the president and CEO of Friedert Hospital. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And just a reminder that you can carry on this conversation because we have this high-tech stuff going on now. And if you go to WPR.org, you can continue the discussion on healthcare reform that we've had here today and enter your comments. We, believe me, we'll use them because we're continuing our series on healthcare for the next few weeks, going to France next week. 800-486-8655. Mary from Milwaukee, hello.
Yes, I wanted to ask Bill if he watched Bill Moyers the other night, PBS, regarding a person that was working for Cigna. I believe his name was, I don't even remember his name, Wendell Botter. It was an excellent program. What he was talking about was back in 1993, the insurance company people were promising everything, and once we basically lost the fight, they went back to the same old, same old. And he, as a person that worked for the insurance company for 15 years, is very worried about that and thinks that this will happen all over again, that they're just talking the talk right now so that we don't change in America. And I also want to say, Lucy, I don't want insurance to run my health care. I thought her passion was wonderful. And I have a passion for health care as well. And I was just wondering if you watched that program.
Unfortunately, I did not. But I'm a big fan of Bill Moyers, and I've seen other programs that he has done. I think this issue of looking at 93 is real important because the steps that occurred there in which, frankly, Congress was the last at play here allowed the kind of opening that I don't think is going to happen this time. I think the insurance industry is taking a very different position on this than they did in 93. From the get-go, they were against any major reform efforts. That's not the case today. Now, you know, obviously, the detail, as the detail comes out, some of that may alter that. But this administration really has learned from 93. They're trying to keep it simple. They're trying to keep as many people at play, and so they're trying to build a broad coalition. And the stakeholders are at the table. And we have to be a part of this process because we've got to be a part of the solution, and we have to have buy-in in that. And I see that occurring, which I didn't see in 93.
That's an interesting point. Thank you very much for your call. You hear the, and you've heard them more than anybody, these horror stories which we hear on the air of people who have lost their jobs or they've got these conditions pre-existing that you talked about earlier and they can't get insurance and they're just wiped out financially. I mean, it shouldn't happen to anybody, hardworking people there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Right.
Do you feel confident that any kind of health reform will take care of those significant problems that so many people face in getting insurance and getting the right kind of coverage, in having some kind of safety net so they won't get wiped out financially?
Well, I wish I could say yes, but I think there are some concerns, obviously. I mean, medical bankruptcy is the leading cause of bankruptcy in this country. So, I mean, it is a huge problem as a part of this, a part of this effort. The issue, though, once there is coverage, as what's occurring now in Massachusetts, is access. So people now assume they have coverage. I mean, in this state, we've done an excellent job, and I'd give the governor kudos in terms of we've expanded the number of people who have access to public programs. And actually, the level of uninsured in this state is becoming relatively modest, except it's concentrated in Milwaukee, which is another issue. But the issue now becomes of access. And unless there is a focus on access, it's going to be what's happening in Massachusetts, which there's now more people covered, but they can't get access to health care. And so some of the issues that they're dealing with, you know, continue unabated as a part of this. I think the bankruptcy concerns would be eliminated, not totally, if more people are covered. But I think that, again, is kind of hard to really predict at this point.
Yeah. Let's go to, I'm not sure how to pronounce your name, from Eau Claire, so please tell me. Hello? Is it Nachiketa?
Nachiketa, yeah.
Nachiketa. All right.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I like the comment that the Australian woman made. I was born in India. I grew up half there, half here. And,
just keep talking.
Yeah. Okay. So, what I wanted to ask is, you know, it is pretty prevalent here that our needs and our rights are the biggest, loudest screams that most Americans make, but the responsibility aspect is not very prevalent. So, how, you know, need is unlimited. So when any free system is available, people take advantage of it. The welfare system and other systems that we have going right now, people are taking undue advantage where they keep having babies and whatnot because it's paid for. How does the doctor, what does he have in mind, or by talking to other international agencies, what does he have in mind about that? And the second is, there's a lot of talk about health insurance, but what about the practices of doctors? I mean, you know, there is no investigative ethic in doctors that are practicing in the United States. I mean, they just prescribe medicine and get you out as quickly as they can.
Bill.
Well, you know, that there are a number of different issues there. I think personal responsibility has to be a part of this. I think that the importance of co-payments and deductibles are important. I believe as insurance may change over time, there have to be built-in incentives for healthy lifestyles. And as more companies have kind of embraced wellness programs, they are trying to shift how the role of the individual to assume greater responsibility. And I think no matter what happens, that has to be a key element. You know, with regard – and I'm not a physician – and I work very closely with physicians and have a lot of respect for them. There is a lot more self-policing than what may appear to the public. I know in our own organization, we're an academic medical center, but there's a constant scrutiny with regard to what's occurring. questioning that goes on. It's team care that is increasingly a part of the healthcare system, so that it's not an individual physician per se that's making decisions. It's the team and the interface that goes on and the discussions and the use of information as a part of that. Now, that isn't necessarily a pervasive model, but it's increasing. And the adherence to national protocols and standards and best practices is occurring, and the systems are more transparent. So I think there are, you know, clearly there are steps that the profession has taken. Yes, you're going to be hearing about horror stories, and good things do happen in excellent hospitals. And so the continued focus on quality has to be unrelenting as a part of this process. And that's why transparency and information technology is so important in this process. But at the end of the day, the individual has to assume some responsibility for this. And that cannot be a government responsibility.
Thank you very much for your call. Let me get your response on Canada here for a moment, because that was our last program. And the guy we talked with loved the system. He was a professor of health studies, et cetera, at the University of Ottawa. But let me give you this fact, which seems to me is fairly striking, that the citizens of Canada have longer life expectancy, lower infant mortality and obesity, and spend less than half of what we do per capita on health care. They do have an emerging physician shortage. They have a longstanding problem of wait times, particularly for elective or specialist treatment. But overall, there is great support among citizens for the Canadian system. And let's just focus on the cost of this, less than half of what we do per capita, and they still have terrific health care, and some indicators better than our health care system. Two questions here is, why not look at Canada for a model? And B, with all this talk that's going on now in Washington and all over the country about reform, do you realistically think that without going to some kind of system like Canada, we can cut our costs that much and include everybody in healthcare in this country?
Well, I think, again, there certainly are attributes of the Canadian system that we can emulate. And I've had an opportunity to work fairly closely with the head of the Canadian Hospital Association. Mm. And again, it's a different mindset of care that is longstanding with regard to how the government and the citizens approach healthcare. That is ingrained, and it's different. And it is not focused on "I want it now" mentality. That makes it real difficult. I mean, we've got more MRIs just in this city than they have throughout Canada in terms of the provinces. So there's a different approach. And call it medical rationing, call it expectations, it's different. There are certain attributes of that we have to look at as a part of this process. But I think our mindset is very different. And that's why I think this is, whatever happens, will probably be more in a transitional phase as a part of it. I do believe the existing system can become more efficient and will become more efficient. And it doesn't necessarily require, quote, to be run by the government. I think the government can provide the right incentives that will deal with this. You know, even if we focused in on this question of interoperability, there's huge costs that could be saved by, and what I would describe is, we have in this country in healthcare what we had in the 1850s when we were trying to create an intercontinental system of transportation. Each state had its own standards of gauge. And it wasn't until Congress mandated the Interstate Commerce Commission and said there will be one standard gauge that we were able to communicate and link east and west. In healthcare, we have very little interoperability. Our health systems don't, our information systems don't talk to one another. There's a lot of redundancy built in because a patient comes in. Even in Medicare, there's not one system. The most efficient system, frankly, is the VA right now, because they've standardized. We haven't standardized, and as a result, there's a lot of duplication that goes on. So I'm one of those that believe government does have a role, but I also believe that the private sector also can be, and is a major strength of what we're doing here. And if we align properly, we can create some significant cost savings that in the day will allow us to cover more people and reduce the costs with better outcomes.
And do you think we can do all of that in the next 2 months?
Well, you know, the first person who talked about health reform was Teddy Roosevelt. And you go back in terms of some of the legislation that he was promulgating at that point, it was pretty far-reaching. I think what is the prevailing motive, though, is the belief that what we're doing today is not sustainable.
Yeah.
You talk to business leaders who are competing on a global basis. They know that the way that healthcare is financed is not sustainable. Those of us in healthcare know that what we're doing today is not sustainable. I don't think there was that feeling, and you know, I was a player in '93, that there was that same kind of understanding that we have to change here. And I think linking this to economic recovery is probably a smart move because it is intertwined. I mean, healthcare being 20% of the GNP.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. Bill Ptasnik, our guest this hour, president and CEO of Friedert Hospital in Milwaukee. Thanks to Jalema Noel for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production. We continue our series on healthcare reform. Next week, we look at France. Our guest will be from France. And just a reminder, you can go to WPR.org and continue this conversation online. That's one of our major questions, and we want to hear your response. Thanks for listening, everybody.